Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. While many argue that we're in a post-truth era, some scholars argue that deception has always been ubiquitous. So in this hour, we'll get some truth about lying. But first, our next guest says that power is decaying in nearly every aspect of life, in conflicts, governance, business, and religion. Why is it changing so fast? And what are the consequences, good and bad? Moises Naim is a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and an internationally syndicated columnist. His book is called The End of Power, From Boardrooms to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. Welcome. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Maria. Delighted to be with you.
Let's start with a definition of power. What is power?
It's the ability of one party, one person, one country to get another to do or stop doing something. And of course, it can get far more complicated than that. And experts have developed highly complex and sophisticated definitions of power. But for our purposes, this is more than enough.
Would persuasion fall into that?
There are two ways of dealing with this. One is changing the structure of a situation. So if you are and I are negotiating the price of a house that I'm selling, if I have the power of changing the structure of the situation, meaning I will lower the price, then I have the ability to make you do something, which is buy the house because I have changed the incentives. But I can do something else. I can explain how good the high schools and schools are around the house, and there I will change the perception you have of the situation, and I am persuading you of doing what I want you to do by changing. No, I haven't changed the structure of the situation. I have shown you a different way of looking at it.
Let's talk about what these four channels of power are.
Well, there are several. One is, of course, the muscle, which is essentially the coercion. The muscle is, of course, the one that is better known, is the most obvious, is the threat of force, is the blunt instrument through which power is exercised in extreme situations. The muscle can take the form of a conquering army, a police force, which is handcuffs and jails, sells a bully in a schoolyard, a knife on the neck, etc. It's the sheer force. Then is the code. The code is essentially the morals, tradition, cultural mores, social expectations, the religious beliefs and values handed down through generations or taught to children in school. And it's very, very powerful in terms of that tradition. It tends to be a very, very important source of behavior. Then there's a pitch, is the ability, that power of advertising, for example, is persuading, is showing advantages or benefits or reasons to do or stop doing something. And then there is the reward. The reward is just providing material incentives, compensation schemes, is all kinds of inducements, material inducements to get someone to do or stop doing something.
And then you've talked also about the scope and constraints on power. What are those and how have they changed?
The essential argument of the book is that those who have power retain it because they have something special, a special asset that shields them from the challenges of others that want that power. That special something can be a technology or it can be a brand name or it can be millions of followers or voters or it can be wealth or a mighty army. And those shields protect the powerful and allow them to continue to be powerful. And my point is that those shields are becoming less protective. There are many sources for this. Of course, when one says that, the initial instinct is to say, well, of course, it's the Internet. It's social media. It's Twitter and Facebook and Google and all of the tools that spread information and disintermediate and create opportunities for newcomers. And, of course, that's one important aspect. But I claim in the book that that's not the main one because technology at the end is a tool, and a tool needs users, and users have incentives and direction and motivations. And so we need to look at the structure of incentives that creates the direction in which these users of technology move and the motivations, really, that they have. And these are changing as a result of tectonic shifts in the world that include but transcend technology and especially the Internet. I'm talking about demographic shifts, changes in the way in which humanity is distributed around the world, the size of the population, the way they move, the way they behave. And so I grouped these many, many factors into three categories that I call the three revolutions: the more, the mobility, and the mentality revolutions.
In fact, you said that it was these rather than the internet itself that enabled the Arab revolutions to happen.
Exactly. If you think, for example, about where it all started in the Arab revolutions, it started in Tunisia. Tunisia is one of the most successful North African countries. It had the highest growth rate in that region. It is a country that was not divided as deeply as others in terms of religious or sectarian conflicts. It was well integrated into Europe. It had high educational levels and in a very fast-growing middle class. And there is where it started. So that tells us something, and that something is that Tunisia was at the center of what I call the three revolutions. It had a lot of expansion. It had more population. It was younger. It was well-educated. What they didn't have was jobs, and it was a very difficult situation in that respect. But that population was not only that it had more of everything. There were more people, but they were more educated. They were more affluent in many ways, and they moved. And that, and the moving, the mobility revolution, in which it is a world in which everything moves more. People, but also goods, services, information, technology, ideology, financial crisis, pandemics, everything moves more. And together, they change the way we think and the way we hope, the way we believe, the way our values change. And that is the mentality, their revolution.
What it really is what was behind the social media, and the social media was merely a tool, one of a few, that enabled these things to be communicated.
Exactly. And then you could see how it spread and how it all started in this small town in the interior of Tunisia. And that then became a revolution in Tunisia and then rapidly spread to Libya and to Yemen and to Egypt, Syria. And you can find in a lot of places around the world these forces at work.
Let's look at your other fundamental premise. Why did you choose the word decay, that power is decaying, rather than that it's really becoming more elusive and more diffuse? Is it really decaying?
Yes, because you can get diffusion without really losing its effectiveness. The power has become easier to get, but much harder to use and easier to lose. It's becoming more fleeting. So not just diffusing. Diffusing means, for example, that power is shifting from Europe and the United States towards Asia, which, of course, is happening, as we know. But that's not the entire story. That has been the dominant narrative until now. But it's more than that is happening. And what is happening is that when power shifts to Asia, those in Asia that acquire a decayed power, a power that yields less benefits, a power that they can do less with. So those that have power now or have acquired power are more limited in what they can do with it, and they are less secure in their holding of that power, and that power, in fact, is more fleeting. That together is why I say that it's decaying and not merely shifting.
And so if you were going to look for evidence of this argument, what would be some of the key places that you would look?
And the book has different chapters on different arenas of human activity. And in all of them, I claim, these trends are visible. They're visible in the world of armed conflict and the military, but also in the religion and churches, in national politics, or international politics. You can also see it in the power of labor unions and in the power of religions.
Let's look at some of these and look at the evidence for each of them. Let's start with conflict.
There's a fantastic, a fascinating study by a Harvard scholar called Ivan Arreguin. He decided to look at armed conflict between two sides in which you could measure the relative strength by the traditional metrics that are used by experts on military conflicts. And so he identified those conflicts between 1850 to 1949. And he discovered that in that period, the weak side, the side that objectively had less military power, won 12% of the time. Then he extended that study from 1950 to 1998, and he discovered that the side that was weaker won 55% of the time. That meant that in modern times, the weak side had more probability to win than the quote-unquote strong part of the conflict, which is quite significant and in fact is a statistical corroboration of something that we're seeing around us, and that is the theme of asymmetric wars. We have seen, for example, how the United States lately has had a hard time winning wars, and mostly what is confronting is new kinds of combatants, insurgents and guerrillas, and all kinds of groups that sometimes they don't win, but they surely deny victory to this mightiest military force ever assembled. We can see it in the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We can see it with the pirates that ply the seas in front of the Gulf of Aden. These people are former fishermen that take out their rickety boats in outboard motor with outboard motors and AK-47, the rifle, the assault rifle, and they are able to hijack and for ransom some of the biggest ships in the world, big tankers and big cargo ships, even passenger ships. And the world has reacted by deploying in those waters one of the most sophisticated flotilla of vessels armed with the latest technologies. And everyone is there. NATO is there, and Ukraine, and Japan, and China. Everyone is patrolling those waters trying to protect the commercial routes. And yet the pirates continue to be able to hijack these very, very big ships. Again, they are not going to win over this mighty force, but they're denying the world powers the ability to ensure a secure travel of their commercial ships. And we see, for example, you know, that of course, the now very well known, the tragically known example of Al-Qaeda. Staging 9/11 cost something about $500,000. But it inflicted damages that are now measured in the trillions of dollars. So this is the kind of new forms of armed conflict that are transforming the nature of the military and are showing that size, for example, or investment and technology no longer guarantee national security and no longer guarantee that you will win over your enemies, even if they are smaller or not that well armed, or not as well equipped and trained as the largest armies.
This is the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Moises Naim about his book, The End of Power. What about in corporate America and multinational corporations? You say they're also losing power.
Yes, and again, there is statistics that supported that view. There's another very interesting study. They looked at the probability that a company that got to the top 20% of its industry would stay there in the following 5 years. In the 1980s, the probability of falling out of that category was only 10%. That meant that if you made it to the top, you were more or less secure. You could relax because you would stay there. 90% probability that 5 years hence, you would still be in the top 20%. But then 2 decades later, the turnover rate doubled. And companies that were at the top, they were no longer that secure. The changes and the challengers were more able to dislodge their well-established behemoths. And that became very slippery at the top, not just for companies, but also for the CEOs. Those very powerful CEOs that are so well paid, sometimes obscenely paid, and are very, undoubtedly, they are very powerful, are being fired at unprecedented rates. Average tenure of a CEO, the top of a company, has essentially declined precipitously in recent years. So there's another interesting study that shows the consequences of reputational accidents. In the 1990s, the probability of a company suffering mightily because of a blunder that would affect its reputation was about 20%. Nowadays, it's 82%, which means that a company has almost certainty that something will happen, that it will damage its brand, its reputation, and so on. These companies that came out on top after a financial crisis, and everyone thought that five financial groups that concentrated so many assets with their CEOs at the helm, that were these masters of the universe, will continue to drive and shape the financial sector. Several of them have been fired, but mostly, Maria, what I would say is that we have no evidence that today companies behave in more corrupt ways than in the past, except that now we know more. There are lots of behaviors that in the past were taken for granted that are now better scrutinized. We have more information. We have the risk of misbehaving, I think, now is evidently more profound, more important. And again, one should not underestimate the power of competition. There is no doubt that there is far more competition now, and companies are constantly being dislodged by new rivals.
And you also point out that governments themselves are being challenged, particularly when they're authoritarian, and that this is part of the decay of power.
Yes, and the numbers there are also quite staggering. The number of authoritarian regimes in the world has declined quite significantly. The electoral democracies in 1990 were just 69. Today is 117. So the number of tyrants, the number of authoritarian governments in the world has declined quite significantly. But it also happening in democracies. If you look at the margins of victory, of electoral victory in democracies around the world, you will discover that they have been shrinking. So in places where elections are free and fair and valid, candidates that win no longer win with the same levels of support and the margins of victory over their rivals as they used in the past. Landslide victories are becoming endangered species. And that means that these governments don't have very strong mandates, that voters don't seem to like to give very strong mandates and power to government. They seem to prefer divided governments, meaning electing a chief executive, a president, or a head of state, a prime minister, but then immediately also voting for a parliament or a congress or a national assembly that is controlled by the opposition. In 30 out of 34 of the largest democracies in the world, this is what's happening. And in many of them, you end up having very unwieldy coalitions and very strange bedfellows, political bedfellows that have to agree and have to find compromises and have these unstable and very often not very functional political arrangements that generate gridlock, that generate situations in which decisions are taken not that effectively, that are delayed, and that effectively do not solve the problems that are in front of them.
Let's talk about the upside and the downside. Some of the upsides, of course, more democracy, more options, power actually being spread out a little bit more. Perhaps it's good that nobody has absolute power, absolutely. But you say there's also all these downsides. Let's go through some of those.
There's much to welcome for us as citizens, as voters, as consumers, as people that want to come up with a new way of challenging established companies. And it's a world that is not as good if you're a monopolist or if you are an authoritarian government. But then there are some downsides, as you mentioned, and one of the downsides is especially notable in the realm of domestic politics, in which in a lot of countries you see the head of state being like Gulliver, tied down by all kinds of Lilliputians, governments that are unable to act either because they are constrained by the legislative in ways that are quite strong, or governments that are limited because the extent of devolution of power from the national capital to state and local governments, or because activist judges are limiting what they can do, or independent central banks are also imposing constraints in their economic policies, or all kinds of non-governmental organizations that also interfere, you know, shape government policies, lobbyists, and all kinds of international forces. So we see national governments that are becoming more and more hobble giants, incapable of acting effectively and timely to deal with the society's problems. And that is one of the downsides. And Frank Fukuyama, a political scientist, has coined a term, vetocracy, which is these democracies are becoming vetocracies, meaning they are full of centers of veto power. No one has enough power to push through an agenda or a vision or a program, but everyone seems to have just enough power to block what everybody else is doing. And that is how you end with stalemate, with gridlock, and with urgent decisions not being tackled effectively.
If you were going to say the most important things that people need to know or how to deal with the changes in power, what would you say that is?
First, know that power is becoming very fleeting, and therefore do not behave as power is permanent or you have it forever or for a long time, and be aware that you have great limits in what you can do with it. Second, try to develop your peripheral vision, meaning your competitor and people or institutions that are going to challenge you are going to come from very improbable, surprising places. They're not going to be your traditional rivals. They may be coming from all kinds of places, both different industries or different regions or different demographies. Third is that tradition may no longer buy as much as it did in the past. And the notion, that famous phrase, this is done this way because it has always been done this way, is more and more ineffective and unaccepted by everyone. And the power of tradition is declining. And finally, beware of size as the main source of power. Size no longer ensures that power is there for, to stay, or that power is enough.
Moises Naim is a scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and an internationally syndicated columnist. The book is called The End of Power, From Boardrooms to Battlefields and Churches to States, Why Being in Charge Isn't What It Used to Be. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Maria.
When we come back, how to tell when somebody is lying. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. While many argue that we're in a post-truth era, some scholars argue that deception has always been ubiquitous. So in this hour, we'll get some truth about lying. Timothy Levine is Distinguished Professor and Chair of Communication Studies at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Deception. David Livingston Smith is Professor of Philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. Bryony Squire-Thompson is a PhD candidate in the School of Psychological Science at the University of Western Australia. She is co-author of the studies Processing Political Misinformation, Comprehending the Trump Phenomena, and Correcting False Information and Memory, Manipulating the Strength of Misinformation Encoding and Its Retraction. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you all with us here talking about the truth of lying. I thought what we would start with is this idea that is in our media, in our dialogue right now, that we're in a post-truth era. This has largely been because of either the man who has been elected president to the United States, Donald Trump, or also because of the accusations of false news. And in the past, David Livingston Smith, you and I on a previous Scholar Circle and a couple of other scholars talked about really that lying and deception is relatively ubiquitous. So I wonder if we're in a different era. Is it more of the same? Is it less of the same? David Livingston Smith, what do you think?
Well, I don't think history is divided into two eras, really. I mean, this is an imposition of categories that we place to try and on history to try and make sense of things. Well, lying is a lying and deception, because I use the term very broadly, is indeed a ubiquitous feature of human life. And so it's not like suddenly we're launched into a time when truth doesn't matter anymore. But there are historical circumstances and political circumstances that I think, at least in this country, the United States, where I'm speaking from, make lying with impunity a lot more tempting and a lot more easy.
Easy and tempting because it's more permitted when the leader is also lying?
Well, no, I think that, see, I think any politician worth their salt is going to be a very skilled image manipulator. And lying is a form of image manipulation. And a skillful politician tells people, deceives them in the way they want to be deceived. Let's put it that way. And I think Trump has the salesman's instinct for doing this. And that's what I think is different. Not that political lying is something new. That's ridiculous. You know, we've known since Plato's Republic that lying is a crucial part of politics. Politicians, he said, serve up sweet pastries that are not nourishing but taste good. What's different is that Donald Trump has really established for himself and for others that he can push the envelope very far indeed if he tells people the sorts of things that motivate them in the way he wants to motivate them.
Timothy Levine, what would you say?
I agree with everything about Trump, but I would like to push back a little bit on the idea that lying is frequent in our communication. I tend to think, and I think the data shows pretty clearly, that most people are mostly honest most of the time. Most people lie less than the average person lies because lying's not normally distributed. There's a few people who lie a lot, and most of us are pretty honest. Even with politicians, if you look at things like, I haven't checked the PolitiFact numbers recently, but most politicians, when they get fact-checked, they don't always come out true, but they come out true more often than not. And Donald Trump's the clear exception of this. I don't know that there's ever, you know, ever been a politician that in recent memory that's been as close to his difficulty with the truth. But even then, remember, those are only the statements that get fact-checked. And there's a lot of statements that don't get fact-checked, primarily because there's no reason to fact-check them, right?
And one of the things in your research, Timothy, was that people lie when they have a reason to lie. And if that reason has been taken away, then they don't usually lie. How do we make sense of that?
Well, people lie or deceive when the truth's a problem. And for probably most everyday adults, the truth isn't especially problematic for us. For example, if I'm on the radio talking about my research findings, the reason I'm here is to explain that to you. You know, hopefully the truth's not a problem. You know, hopefully I'm not fudging my data or making up evidence. And if I were, it probably wouldn't make sense to have a show like this, right?
I wonder also, since you're in the communication field and one of the issues in communication deals with the idea of contagion, is contagion a problem when it comes to deception?
I don't know. Good question. But I do think the really insidious thing about the current political environment is not only the giving false information, but attacking the credibility of those who fact check. Right. So now the fact checkers are the fake media. And this this I find really troubling, because how are we to know what's true or not? And it seems to me that communication can only work with when we trust what others are saying, and we move towards anarchy if just anything goes.
Right. And that's something else you've written about, which is how much we actually need to be able to trust in order for our general society to function.
Yeah, it's really hard to be close to people or have good cooperative relationships if you can't trust them. I'm a professor. If students can't trust me, there's no reason to pay the high tuition dollars. That would be silly. Yeah, things unravel pretty quickly if we can't believe what other people say. If we have to trust anything, communication just loses all its utility.
Brioni, this might be the place to bring you in. Brioni Squire-Thompson, she's been studying when people accept or don't accept information that's wrong. What can you tell us about this process?
What we find is even if people are presented with these really good, valid, evidence-based corrections, they might update their beliefs in the short period of time. But if we measure it, say, you know, a week later, 3 weeks later, they start to re-believe in the original misconception. And I guess that's one of the phenomena that's pretty scary to think that we call it the continued influence effect of misinformation, because misinformation or, you know, these lies that people are presenting really do have an impact on our reasoning and memory, like well into the future.
Walk us through this. First of all, they hear the deception or the lie, and if they accept it, then what happens?
Right. So the way that we study it in the lab is we often present people with like multiple pieces of information, and we ask people to rate on a 0 to 10 scale how much do you believe in, you know, in this piece of information. Once they've done their ratings, we give them like a little blurb to say, well, this is actually true because of these reasons, or this is false. And then we measure participants over a period of time. And yeah, what we do find is they're quite happy to update their beliefs in the short term. But yeah, the corrections don't seem to last.
There was another study, which is depending on who was attached to the information, that had an effect on whether or not they continued to believe it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was actually a study that we did using Trump, because he was an incredibly polarizing figure. We set up these studies in 2015 and 2016, and he was obviously already a highly divisive figure. And we said, for example, one of the items was Trump said that the MMR vaccine causes autism, or we just presented just the information saying the MMR vaccine causes autism, how much do you believe in statement? And we found initially straight off the bat, without correcting people's misconceptions, if people were Trump supporters, they're far more likely to believe in the misconception. So what we think is happening here is that people are using political figures, people who they trust, as what we call like a heuristic. So it's a mental shortcut for judging the veracity of information. So they're like, I trust Trump, and therefore I think what he says is true. And I don't think this is necessarily only for political figures or only for Republicans or Trump supporters. I think this is trust in source, and source credibility is a big thing when judging how true or false information is.
You know, it's interesting. It sort of goes hand in hand also with the work that some psychologists have done with the brain scans. And once people have become sort of wedded to a particular position or a particular candidate, they actually measured the cognitive dissonance that they experienced when somebody gave them counter information. David Livingston Smith, what do you make of this?
Well, there's contagion. Let's actually start with something a little bit more basic. You've sometimes spoken of lies and sometimes spoken of deception. And I think one of the differences between Tim and I is that Tim has a pretty fine-grained notion of lying. And I use lying as pretty much synonymous with deception. And I do agree with him, by the way, that most of the time we don't lie. If that were not the case, then lies would have no utility, as the story of the boy who cried wolf tells us. Okay, so contagion. I think maybe it's a little bit of a misleading metaphor. What happens, I think, is that prominent people, people who are looked up to, and in the case of Trump, looked up to as a sort of savior, set norms. They set norms of permissibility by their behavior. So if someone like Trump sort of suggests that one can play fast and loose with the truth, I doubt very much that this does not impact those who look up to him.
In that case, it would just be those that look up to him that would therefore be affected. It's not like it would create a culture of deception.
You know, these things sort of create a cultural atmosphere. And presumably there are a lot of psychological processes at work here, and I wouldn't presume to specify them. But yeah,
May I jump in? Sorry. When you're finished.
Go ahead, Brian.
I was just going to mention that that's actually one of the things we measured in a study regarding Trump, when even if people who supported Trump updated their beliefs that what he was saying wasn't true, that we gave them correction and they were like, yes, we completely acknowledge that what he's saying is false. It didn't actually have any impact on their voting preferences. So people were just as likely to vote for him, even if they were acknowledging that they knew that he was spreading inaccurate information. What we assumed this meant was that why people like political figures is made up of a whole range of factors, but yeah, I guess being truthful in our experiment wasn't one of them.
Yeah, may I respond?
Yes, please.
That's pretty cool research. I think that what goes on with authoritarian leaders and all the more for totalitarian leaders, is that the faithful followers see them as sort of being in touch with a deeper truth. So although the details might not correspond to reality, they're seen as articulating something which is true in a more profound and deep sense. That's one way that this problem gets negotiated.
Timothy Levine?
My theoretical perspective is called truth default theory. And the basic idea is that we tend to believe other people unless we have reason not to. So our default state is belief. And then at times we're motivated to think carefully about is this true or not. So I think, for example, with the followers of a particular leader, they have a stake at believing this person. So they're decidedly not motivated to believe them. The other side of the political spectrum, they're scrutinizing. And so they're looking for it. If the statements aren't true, then they're more likely to try to fact check and look at that. It's a much more general principle that generally we kind of, you know, it's like when we're driving, we're kind of on autopilot. We're not really consciously thinking about things, right? And then something comes and grabs our attention. You know, some driver's behaving unusually or something, and we start thinking about it. Communication's a lot like this too. We tend to do it very automatically. And it's only when we have to really start thinking about, is this deceptive? Am I being lied to? That has to come actively to mind. If it's not prompted in some way, I use the word trigger, if it's not triggered. And one of the things that can trigger it would be a politician from an opposite party. One of the things that could trigger it would be a salesperson who's giving you a hard sales pitch. Maybe in certain kind of online dating environments or internet environments, you might be very on guard for people saying things that are false. But in most of our daily lives, this just doesn't occur to us. So this is why I think that we are much more likely to be skeptical of people who have different belief systems than us, or in different tribes or different groups.
Is this a problem in an age where there are massive numbers of websites that might proliferate information that's absolutely false?
Right. Or with, let's say, email phishing attacks. You know, if you're just going along in autopilot, it's really easy to click on those links. You have to be actively thinking about it. And actively thinking about it takes effort away from doing other things.
And so when you studied why people lie, because they had to have a reason, what were those reasons?
Yes. The exception is with pathological lying, which I define as lying without a reason. So occasionally you'll run into people who will tell a lie when the truth would work better. But for most of us, the reason we deceive is that for some reason the truth is a problem. Maybe we did something wrong. So transgressions are a big reason. We did something wrong. We're trying to hide it. We want to make a positive impression on other people. There might be some kind of economic advantage to it. You know, I want you to think my product's really better than it is, or I want you to vote for me. A surprisingly big one is a category my co-authors and all called avoidance lies. Basically, your friend or somebody wants you to do something. You don't want to go out to dinner with them for whatever reason, but you don't want to say, no, I don't want to go out with you. So you make up some kind of reason, like there's the vacuous, I have plans, or I'm sorry, I have a prior engagement, or something like that. But the truth is, you just don't want to do it.
So how ubiquitous did you find that this deception, this actual lying occurred among people? Is it all the time, every day, or is it really rare?
I think most people don't lie very often. We've done nationwide surveys in both UK and US, where most people say they haven't really lied in the last 24 hours. And we gave them a pretty broad definition of it, just generally misleading another person.
Could they be lying about lying?
They could be, but there's been some cool validation studies to give people opportunity to cheat for a cash prize. And the people who admit to lying tend to cheat. And the people who say they're honest tend not to cheat in behavioral studies.
David Livingston-Smith, what would you say about all this?
I'm kind of skeptical. Every day I go to the supermarket, I'm asked by the usually young woman at the cash register, how are you? And I'm expected, like everyone else, to say fine. And I don't. And actually, they find it quite a relief because they're in a miserable job and they've been on their feet all day. But there's a great deal of that that goes on. I think people are generally unaware of the degree to which they lie. And bear in mind, again, that by lying, I don't restrict lying to deliberate statements intended to cause others to form false beliefs. I include in lying any form of behavior which has the function of causing others to form false beliefs. So I think lying is much more pervasive. And I think I agree with Tim that people lie. I mean, I would put it a little bit differently. The way he puts it is truth is a problem. I say people lie often to get things that they value, which they feel they can get more effectively by lying than by telling the truth. People want others to love them, to think well of them, and so on. But people also lie because they enjoy it. I mean, I hold as an example of that the stories that are told to children about Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and so on and so forth, which seems to me a matter of the pure exercise of power of a big, strong, knowledgeable person over a small, vulnerable one.
That's interesting. Go ahead. Did you want to respond?
Oh, I was going to jump in. This is Tim. I tend not to see "hello, how are you, fine" as deception. Because I asked David how he's doing, and he says he's fine. Yeah. I don't really believe he is. I know that we say this all the time, right? And there's no deceptive function. If I said, "How are you doing?" and he said, "I'm having a really great day," and he wasn't, then I might be deceived. But the everyday little politeness rituals we have, I don't think serve a deceptive function. Because every member of the language community knows perfectly well that this is just what we say. And everybody knows that when you answer fine or what's up, nothing, that means nothing more than I'm just following this mindless sequence.
Sure. But isn't that a refraining from telling the truth? So if you have someone who's there, basically feels like she wants to jump off a bridge, and I say to her, "How are you doing?" And she says, "Fine." She's not misstating. She's engaging in a social ritual, even though she is inside dying to let someone know what her life is like.
This is Tim again. We might be at the risk of jumping into a real rabbit hole here. We want to be very careful, I think, in talking about deception, not to conflate truth with deceptiveness, because I can be deceptive while being 100% truthful.
Of course, I agree.
Right? So I can say something sarcastically that I mean is literally true.
Yes.
Right? And I can say something absolutely false, like with sarcasm, that's not deceptive at all.
That's right.
So I think David and I are on the same page on what deception is. So deception is that which communication or other signals which function to mislead someone.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I think we're actually on the same page.
Yes,
we just differ in the specific examples, like "how are you? I'm fine."
Mm-hmm. What I'm going to do is bring David Livingston Smith in on another dimension that he's also written about, which is about self-deception. Mm. David, you have said in the past that we are frequently in a mode of self-deception, and that perhaps this is to keep us from being sad or depressed or upset. What about that? Is there any harm done there?
Well, I'd like to broaden it out. No, I don't. There's not necessarily any harm done there at all. I think optimal self-deception is a requirement for keeping sane in this crazy world. Self-deception is a really complicated and difficult topic. There are problems. Philosophers have written a lot about this, like problems understanding how it could work and what it is and so on. And I'm not going to get into that. That would take an hour's lecture to begin to try and make sense of. But I think that the usefulness of self-deception is broader than what you specify. So truth can be really, really overrated. So let's start with what you said. Yeah, I mean, I'm wearing shorts that I got cheap someplace. They're probably made by people working at ridiculous starvation wages under horrible circumstances. And I know that, but I kind of don't pay attention to it. because if I paid attention to it, I would feel horrendously guilty and guilty that I'm not sufficiently politically engaged to try the hell to do something about these sorts of things. And I know I'm 60, almost 64 years old. I don't have that many years left. I know I'm going to die. Oh, that's a bad thought. I can tolerate it occasionally. I know that my loved ones are going to die. I know that there's tremendous suffering around me. And I'm a darker person than most, but even me, I have to ignore that stuff in order to keep going. But, you know, self-deception can have other functions as well. The assumption that the truth is always better. To know the truth about yourself is always better. To know the truth about others is always better. I think is an unwarranted assumption. And self-deception can be the balm that helps us get through the night and helps us get what we want as well. Because, of course, if we believe our own bullshit, we're much more, presumably, much more effective at getting others to believe it.
Spoken like a true philosopher. What would the communication professor say?
I think self-deception is somewhat out of the realm of communication. But the work on self-deception I find really interesting is an evolutionary biologist by the name of Robert Trivers. He makes the same point that David made at the end, that the real advantage of self-deception is that it serves other deception, that if we believe our own bullshit, then we're way more believable. And I'm not sure how much I agree with Trivers' exact argument, but I find it really interesting, and I think if he's right about that, it turns at least a lot of the psychological research on deception kind of on its head.
Talk about a little of the costs of this, both on a person and on society in terms of communication deception. Tim, I think you mentioned that you can tell somebody's deception or they're lying not by what they say, but why they do?
It's the exact opposite in my research. The principle that's guided most research on deception detection is that you want to not pay attention to what people say, and you want to pay attention to what people do and various nonverbal behaviors. And that view was characterized very well in the TV show Lie to Me that was on. What my research finds is the exact opposite, that if you're paying attention to how people are coming off, then you're very likely to be misled. But if you listen carefully to what they say, and if possible, fact check, if not, assess it for plausibility, hopefully understand what they say in the context in which it's said, then we're much better able to sort out truth from lie. And the other thing my research finds is that most lies that people detect are detected well after the fact. So we've asked people, think about a time you caught somebody lying to you and how'd you find out? Something like 98% of those are found out later.
You looked at relationships as well in terms of how that occurs within relationships. What did you find there?
The big finding in relationships is it's not so much the lying, but what the lies are about. So when you lie about the wrong thing, that's really what damages the relationship. You know, if I'm lying to you about a surprise party, you're probably that's not going to hurt our relationship that much. But spouses who are lying about infidelity, that can really hurt the relationship once the lies are uncovered. But it's not just the lies, it's the underlying problematic things that were being hidden.
And Bryony, what are your findings with regards to this, with the deceiver or the person receiving the deceptive information?
I guess first I'd like to jump on the bandwagon of definitions of, I guess with my research, when I look into like misinformation, it isn't necessarily someone with the intent to deceive. So that could be coming back to like self-deception. Sometimes I think that people believe these lies so much that they do have a way of coming off as believing it is true, even if that's not the case. But yeah, misinformation, I mean, it could be deception, but it could also be just spreading inaccurate information that people like really do have a strong disposition to believe in first.
Well, I guess one of the questions for you in terms of, because you're mostly studying how people receive and process information, right? You're not actually studying the people who are lying. You're studying the reception of lying. One of the things I thought was so interesting, you were saying that they come back to their original state. During that process, when they are in the, oh, we found out this isn't true, but now we're going to go back to our original position, have you interviewed these people to have a sense of, do they have cognitive dissonance? Do they feel betrayed? Do they have this psychological effect?
I would love to interview them. I think my research is quantitative, not qualitative, but I think some of the most interesting experiences have been, I mean, I have quite a few studies done online, but when I was working in a lab, you actually got to speak with these people, and it was always very interesting, and people always had these queries of, well, am I remembering what you told me was true? Is that what I'm answering? Or am I still answering what I truly believe? And I do think that there, when we correct information, there's still a big disconnect between what people remember that, you know, a source told them and what they still believe. Yeah, it's definitely a very interesting phenomenon.
David Livingston Smith.
I think the whole idea of belief is a really interesting idea. I think a lot of times when people say they believe something, what they mean is they're committed to it. There's kind of getting behind it. And evidential considerations don't play much of a role in that. I mean, you see that in New England here with sports fans. They will say that they believe that the Red Sox are the greatest team in the world. And that's entirely unrelated to how well they're doing in a particular season, right? It's a gesture of commitment. It's like saying, go Red Sox, right? Similarly, you know, my students in Intro to Philosophy, when we look at philosophers' criticisms of the purported proofs of God's existence, and we see pretty plainly that those proofs just don't hold up, students will absorb that, you know, they'll understand the logic and they'll say, you know, but I still believe. And they believe because they were raised that way. That's the claim.
Sounds a lot like Bryony's research, like maybe for a moment they let go of that, but then they go back to it.
Yeah, because it's the commitment that matters rather than the evidence that matters.
Tim Levine?
I'm really understanding belief, and particularly when we believe other people's communication, is a really cool thing to think about too. In my research, I focused on what people do that make them believable. And it seems that what people do that make them believable is completely unrelated to whether they're actually should be believed or not. But there's this whole combination, whole constellation of behaviors that make people believable. And as it turns out, these things are all interrelated. So if you do these things, if you're friendly and you're confident and you're engaged and you know, you're looking the person in the eye, then pretty much almost everybody will believe you. And if you're not doing those things, if you're coming off as nervous and sketchy and adding a lot of, like, we scientists do a lot of qualifications, or we academics, because all academics do that, then this can undercut your believability. I find that fascinating at just how powerful these things are.
It's interesting, too, in terms of the political environment, because one of the things that in a previous scholar circle, they talked about the appearance of authenticity and the appearance of sincerity and how much of a role that plays. And when we're talking about Donald Trump, who is in the fact-checking world, what they would call pants on fire most of the time, but he comes across as he's sincere and authentic. How do you make sense of that?
I call it the believability quotient, and I actually have this checklist of 11 things. And I found, for example, that people who are both lying and telling the truth, or liars who do these things, even professional interrogators will get right only about 16% of the time. But when the people are honest and do the exact same thing, people are 100% right about them.
Wait, say that again. I'm not sure I followed that. So you said that...
So if I'm coming off as really believable and I'm lying, even professional interrogators will be wrong about me 80%+ of the time. But if I'm actually honest in doing these things, then they'll be right about me. And the interesting thing is these show up cross-culturally. So I've replicated I'm in Korea right now. I've replicated the findings here. So I show Koreans videotapes of Americans high in this believability quotient. They believe them and low in it, and they don't believe them.
Bryony, what do you make of that?
Oh, yeah, I think it sounds like great research. I think that believability, you know, really does go hand in hand with deception and why people lie. And in a way, like, it's the flip side. What we believe and why we believe it is, I think, there's so many working parts, and it's definitely like, large.
Yeah, and can I jump in?
Yes,
I would
please.
Love to see what's going on in the brain scanner when people are watching these highly believable people or watching these highly sketchy people.
Now, when you're talking about the high believability people, who are actually lying, would that fall into the pathological side?
Not necessarily, I think. So at least in the way I would use the term, what makes lying pathological is that they're lying when the truth would work just as well. So there's no reason for lying. They're just lying to lie. And that's different than, I think, a really effective liar, a highly believable liar, who's doing it very strategically, or might be using it very, very strategically and very successfully.
Yes, please, Bryony.
Just on that note, and bringing it full circle back to politics and 2016 presidential campaign, when that is paired with our finding of even if people reduced their belief in the misinformation, they didn't change their voting preferences. It was actually a very effective strategy by the Trump campaign. I mean, who's to say whether or not it's an explicit strategy that was used, but if you're able to get all the benefits of this like additional news coverage and arousing rhetoric, but you don't have the negative consequences of being caught out and spreading the misinformation. Yeah, maybe perhaps a good way to go.
Final word, David Livingston Smith.
Yeah, well, with respect to believability, I totally agree. I mean, it's the skilled liar, the trick to being a good liar, a skilled liar, a competent liar, is to be believable. Otherwise, there's no point. So I can do no better than to quote one of my favorite philosophers, Marx, not Karl, but Groucho, who once said that sincerity is important. If you can fake that, you can fake anything.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
Timothy Levine is Distinguished Professor and Chair of Communication Studies at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Deception. David Livingston Smith is Professor of Philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. Bryony Squire-Thompson is a PhD candidate in the School of Psychological Science at the University of Western Australia. She is co-author of the studies Processing Political Misinformation, Comprehending the Trump Phenomena, and Correcting False Information and Memory, Manipulating the Strength of Misinformation Encoding and Its Retraction. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.